Chapter 10. The company did think the world of him, indeed. Fireworks, prodigious banquets, treasures of naval stores poured out, such kind attentions to the crew while the surprise was repairing that scarcely a man was sober or single from the day they dropped anchor to the day they weighed it, a sullen, brutal, debauched and dissipated band. This was gratitude expressed in food, in entertainment on the most lavish scale, in oriental splendour, and in many, many speeches, all couched in terms of unmixed praise, and it brought Jack into immediate contact with Richard Canning. At the very first official dinner he found Canning at his right, a Canning filled with affectionate admiration, who eagerly claimed acquaintance. Jack was astonished. He had scarcely thought twice about Canning since Bombay, and since the engagement with Lenoir, not at all. He had been perpetually busy nursing the poor, shattered, fainting surprise across the sea, even with a favourable wind and the devoted help of every Indiaman whose people could find footing aboard her. And Stephen, with a sick bay full and some delicate operations, including poor Bowes's head, had barely exchanged a dozen unofficial words with him that might have brought Diana or Canning to his mind. But here was the man at his side, friendly, unreserved, and apparently unconscious of any call for reserve on either part, present to do him honour, and indeed to propose his health in a well-turned, knowledgeable, and really gratifying speech, a speech in which Sophia hovered, decently veiled, together with Captain Aubrey's imminent, lasting, and glorious happiness. After the first stiffness and embarrassment, Jack found it impossible to dislike him, and he made little effort to do so, particularly as Stephen and he seemed so well together. Besides, any distance, any coldness on a public occasion, would have been so marked, so graceless, and so churlish, that he could not have brought himself to it, even if the offence had been even greater and far more recent. It occurred to him that in all probability Canning had not the least notion of having cut him out long ago, oh so long ago, in another world. Banquets, receptions, a ball that he had to decline because that was the day they buried Bowes, and it was a week before he ever saw Canning in private. He was sitting at his desk in his cabin, with his injured foot in a bucket of warm oil of sesame, writing to Sophie, "The sword of honour they have presented me with is a very handsome thing in the Indian taste, I believe, with a most flattering inscription. Indeed, if kind words were halfpence, I should be a nabob, and, oh, sweetheart, a married nabob. The company, the Parsee merchants, and the insurers have made up a splendid purse for the men that I am to distribute, but in their delicacy—" when Canning was announced. "Beg him to step below," he said, placing a whale's tooth upon his letter against the fetid hooly breeze. "Mr. Canning, a good morning to you, sir. Pray sit down. Forgive me for receiving you in this informal way, but Maturin will flay me if I rise up from my oil without leave." Civil inquiries for the foot. "Vastly better, I thank you." And Canning said,
"I have just pulled round the ship, and upon my word I do not know how you ever brought her in. I absolutely counted 47 great shots between what was left of your cutwater and the stump of the larboard cat head, and even more on the starboard bow. Just how did the Marengo lay?"
Few landsmen would have had more than the briefest general account, but Canning had been to sea. He owned privateers, and he had fought one of them in a spirited little action. Jack told him just how the Marengo lay, and led on by Canning's close, intelligent participation in every move, every shift of wind, he also told him how the Semillante and Belle Poule had lain, and how the gallant Berceau had tried to lay, drawing diagrams in oil of sesame on the tabletop.
"Well," said Canning with a sigh, "I honour you, I am sure. It was the completest thing. I would have given my right hand to be there. But then I've never been a lucky man, except perhaps in trade. Lord, Lord, how I wish I were a sailor, and a great way from land."
He looked down-spirited and old, but reviving, he said,
"It was the completest thing, the Nelson touch."
"Ah, no, sir, no," cried Jack. "There you mistake it. Nelson would have had Marengo. There was a moment when I almost thought we might. If that noble fellow Mackay in Royal George could only have brought up the rear a little faster, or if Lenoir had lingered but a minute to thump us again, the van would have been up, and we had him between two fires. But it was not to be. It was only a little brush, after all, another indecisive action, and I dare say he is refitting in Batavia at this moment."
Canning shook his head, smiling.
"It was not altogether unsuccessful, however," he said. "A fleet worth 6 million of money has been saved, and the country, to say nothing of the company, would have been in a strange position if it had been lost. And that brings me to the purpose of my visit. I am come at the desire of my associates to find out, with the utmost tact and delicacy, how they may express their sense of your achievement in something more, shall I say, tangible than addresses, mountains of Pilau, and indifferent Burgundy. Something perhaps more negotiable, as we say in the city. I trust I do not offend you, sir.
Not in the least, sir, said Jack.
Well, now, seeing that anything resembling a direct gratification is out of the question with a gentleman of your kind, where do you get these wild romantic notions?
Thought Jack, looking wistfully into his face.
Some members suggested a service of plate or Suraj ud Dowlah's gold-mounted palanquin, but I put it to them that a service of plate on the scale they suggested would take a year or so to reach your table, that to my personal knowledge you were already magnificently supplied with silver.
Jack possessed 6 plates, at present in pawn,
and that a palanquin, however magnificent, was of little use to a sea officer, and it occurred to me that freight was the answer to our problem. Am I too gross, speaking with this freedom?
Oh, no, no, cried Jack. Use no ceremony, I beg.
But he was puzzled. Freight money, that charming, unlooked-for, unlaborious, almost unearned shower of gold, fell only on those fortunate captains of men-of-war who carried treasure for government, or for the owners of bullion or specie who did not choose to trust their concentrated wealth to any conveyance less sure. It amounted to 2 or 3% of the value carried, and very welcome it was. Although it was far rarer than prize money, the sea officer's only other road to a decent competence, it was surer. It had no possible legal difficulties attached, and no man had to risk his ship, his life, or his career in getting it. Like every other sailor, Jack knew all about freight money, but none had ever come his way. He felt a glowing benevolence towards Canning, yet still he was in a state of doubt. Bullion travelled out to India, not back to England. The company's wealth sailed home in the form of tea and muslin, cashmere shawls. He had never heard of bullion homeward bound.
You may be aware that the Lushington was carrying Borneo rubies, one of our shipments of gems, said Canning, and we have a consignment of Tinnevelly pearls as well as 2 parcels of sapphires. The whole amounts to no great value, I fear, not even 250,000, but it takes no room either. You would not be incommoded. May I hope to persuade you to convey it, sir?
I believe you may, sir, said Jack, and I am exceedingly obliged to you for the, delicate, gentlemanlike way this offer has been made.
You must not thank me, my dear Aubrey. There is not the least personal obligation. I am only the mouthpiece of the company. How I wish I could be of some direct service. If there is any way in which I can be of use, I should be most happy. Would it, for example, be of any interest to you to send a message to England? If you were to put a few thousand into Bohea and Mohair futures, you might well clear 30% before you were home. Some cousins and I keep up an overland mail, and the courier is on the wing. He goes by way of Suez.
Mohair futures, said Jack, in a wondering voice. I shall be tolerably at sea there, I am afraid. But I tell you what it is, Canning. I shall be infinitely obliged if your man would take me a private letter. You shall have it in 10 minutes. How kind. How very kind.
He turned Canning over to Pullings for a thorough tour of the ship, with a particular recommendation that he should view the stringers abaft the manger and the state of the bits, and resumed his letter.
"Sophie, dear, here's the prettiest thing in the world. John Company is stuffing the ship with treasure. You and I are to get freight, as we say. She'll explain it to you later. Very like prize, but the men don't share, nor the Admiral neither this time, since I'm under Admiralty orders. Is not that charming?" No vast great thumping sum, but it will clear me of debt and set us up in a neat cottage with an acre or two. So you are hereby required and directed to proceed to Madeira forthwith, and here is a note for Heneage Dundas, who will be delighted to give you a passage in Athalian if he is still on the packet run, or to find one of our friends bound there if he is not. Lose not a moment. You may knit your wedding dress aboard. In great haste and with far greater love, Jack. P.S. Stephen is very well. We had a brush with Lenoir. Old Heneage, as you love me, give Sophie a passage to Madeira, or if you cannot, stir up Clowes, Seymour, Rieu, any of our reliable, sober friends, and if you can ship a respectable woman as, say, Boatswain's servant, you would infinitely oblige. Yours ever, Jack Aubrey. P.S. Surprise had a mauling from Marengo, 74, but paid her back with interest, and the moment her bow knees are something like, I put to sea. This comes overland, and I dare say it will outrun me by a couple of months.
Here you are, sir,
he cried, seeing Canning's bulk darken the cabin door.
"Signed, sealed, and delivered. I am most uncommon grateful."
"Not at all. I shall give it to Atkins directly, and he will take it to the courier before he leaves."
"Atkins? Mr. Stanhope's Atkins?"
"Yes. Dr. Maturin gave me a chit for him. It seems that with the envoy dying in that unhappy way, he was out of a place. Are you acquainted with him?"
"He came out in surprise, of course. But really, I hardly saw anything of the gentleman."
"Ah, indeed. That reminds me, I've not had the pleasure of seeing Maturin for some days now."
"Nor have I. We meet at these splendid dinners, but otherwise he is busy at the hospital or running about the country looking for bugs and tigers."
"Be so good as to call me an elephant," said Stephen.
"Sahib at once. Does the Sahib prefer a male elephant or a female elephant?"
"A male elephant. I should be more at home with a male elephant.
Would the Sahib wish me to bring him to a house of boys? Cleaned, polite boys like gazelles that sing and play the flute?"
"No, Mohammed. Just the elephant, if you please."
The enormous grey creature knelt down, and Stephen looked closely into its wise little old eye, gleaming among the paint and embroidery.
"The Sahib places his foot here upon the brute."
"I beg your pardon,"
murmured Stephen at the vast archaic ear, and mounted. They rode down the crowded Chowringhee, Mohammed pointing out objects of interest.
"There lives Mirza Shah, decrepit, blind. Kings trembled at his name. There Kumar the Rich, an unbeliever. He has 1,000 concubines. The Sahib is disgusted. Like me, the Sahib looks upon women as tattling, guileful, tale-bearing, noisy, contemptible, mean, wretched, unsteady, harsh, inhospitable. I will bring him a young gentleman that smells of honey. This is the Maidan. The Sahib sees 2 peepal trees near the bridge. God give him sight forever. That is where the European gentlemen come to fight one another with swords and pistols. The building beyond the bridge is a heathen temple full of idols. We cross the bridge. Now the Sahib is in Alipur."
In Alipur. Vast walled gardens, isolated houses. Here a Gothic ruin with a true pagoda in its grounds. There a homesick Irishman's round tower. The elephant padded up a gravel drive to a portico, very like the portico of an English country house, apart from the deep recesses on either side for the tigers, and the smell of wild beasts that hung beneath its roof. They paced out and looked not at, but towards him, with implacable eyes. Their chains still dragged upon the ground, yet their faces were so close together that their whiskers mingled, and it was impossible to say from which cavernous chest came the growl that filled the echoing porch with this low, continuous sound. The porter's infant child, woken by the organ note, applied himself to a winch, and the tigers were heaved apart.
"Infant child?" said Stephen. "State the names and ages of thy beasts."
"Father of the poor, their names are right and wrong. They are of immemorial antiquity, having been in this portico even before I was born.
Yet the territory of the one overlaps the territory of the other.
Maharaj, my understanding does not reach the word overlap, but no doubt it is so.
Child, accept this coin."
Stephen was announced.
"Here is that physical chap again,"
said Lady Forbes, peering at him under her shading hand.
"You must admit he has a certain air, has seen good company, but I never trust these half-castes.
Good afternoon, sir.
I trust I see you well, my sawbones Romeo. They've been at it hammer and tongs and thrown in the bloody coal scuttle too. She would have reduced me to tears if I had any left to shed.
You'll find me at my tea, sir. May I offer you a cup? I lace it with gin, sir, the only thing against this hot, relaxing damp. Kumar!
Where is that black sodomite?
Another cup! So you have buried poor Stanhope, I hear. Well, well, we must all come to it. That's my comfort. Lord, the young men I have seen buried here. Mrs. Villiers will be down presently. Perhaps I will pour you another cup and then help her with her gown. She will be lying there stark naked, sweating under the punkah.
I dare say you would like to go and help her yourself, young fellow, for all your compassé airs. Don't tell me you have no la. I am a coarse old woman, and to think I was once a girl. Alas, alas!"
"Stephen, my conquering hero," cried Diana, coming in alone. "How glad I am to see your phiz at last. Where have you been all these days? Did you not have my note? Sit down, do, and take off your coat. How can you bear this wicked heat? We are beside ourselves with stickiness and vexation, and you look as cool as... How I envy you! Is that your elephant outside? I will have him led into the shade at once. You must never leave an elephant in the sun."
She called a servant, a stupid man who did not understand her directions at once, and her voice rose to a tone that Stephen knew well.
"When I saw an elephant coming up the drive," she said, smiling again, "I thought it was that boar Johnston he is always calling. Not that he is really a boar, an interesting man, in fact, an American. You would like him. Have you ever met an American?" "Nor had I before this. Perfectly civilized, you know. All that about their spitting on the floor is so much stuff. And immensely rich, too. But it is embarrassing, and a source of these perpetual goddamn scenes. How I hate a man that makes scenes, particularly in this weather, when the least exertion brings you out in a muck sweat. Everybody is furious in this weather. But what made you come on an elephant, Stephen, dressed in a bloom-coloured coat?"
It was clear to a man with far less knowledge of morphology than Stephen possessed that there was nothing under Diana's gown, and he looked out of the window with a light frown. He wished his mind to be perfectly clear. He said,
"The elephant stands for splendour and confidence. These last weeks, ever since the ship turned back from the Sumatra coast, I have noticed a look of settled and increasing anxiety upon my face. I see it when I shave. I also feel the set of my features, head, neck, shoulders, the expressive parts. From time to time I look, and again I verify that it is indeed this expression of an indwelling, undefined and general apprehension, or even dread. I dispel it. I look cheerful and alert, perhaps confident, and in a few moments it is there again. The elephant is to deal with this. You will remember the last time we met, I begged you would do me the honour of marrying me."
"I do, Stephen," cried Diana, blushing.
He had never seen her blush, and it moved him.
"Indeed I do. But, oh, why did you not say so long ago? At Dover, say. It might have been different then, before all this."
She took a fan from the table and stood up, flicking it nervously.
"God, how hot it is today," she said,
and her expression changed.
"Why wait till now? Anyone would say I had brought myself so low that you could do something quixotic. Indeed, if I were not so fond of you, and I am fond of you, Maturin, you are a friend I love, I might call it a great impertinence, an affront. No woman of any spirit will put up with an affront. I have not degraded myself."
Her chin began to pucker. She mastered it and said,
"I have not come down to—"
But in spite of her pride, the tears came running fast. She bowed her head on his shoulder, and they ran down his bloom-coloured coat.
"In any case," she said between her sobs, "you do not really wish to marry me. You told me yourself long ago. The hunter does not want the fox."
"What the devil are you about, sir?"
cried Canning from the open door.
"What is that to you, sir?"
said Stephen, turning sharp upon him.
"Mrs. Villiers is under my protection,"
said Canning. He was pale with fury.
"I give no explanations to any man for kissing a woman, unless it is his wife."
"Do you not?"
"I do not, sir. And what does your protection amount to? You know very well Mrs. Canning will be here in the Hastings on the 16th. Where is your protection, then? What kind of consideration is this?"
"Is that true, Canning?" cried Diana.
Canning flushed deeply.
"You have been tampering with my papers, Maturin. Your man Atkins has been tampering with my papers."
He stepped forward, and in his passion he gave Stephen a furious, open-handed blow. Instantly Diana thrust a table between them and pushed Canning back, crying out,
"Pay no attention, Stephen. He does not mean it. It is the heat. He is drunk. He will apologize. Leave the house at once, Canning. What do you mean by this low, vulgar brawling? Are you a groom, a pot boy? You are ridiculous."
Stephen stood with his hands behind his back. He too was very pale, apart from the red print of Canning's hand. Canning at the door snatched up a chair and beat it on the ground. He wrenched the back apart, flung it down, and ran out.
"Stephen," said Diana, "do not notice it. Do not fight him. He will apologize. He will certainly apologize. Oh, do not fight him. Promise me he will apologize."
"Perhaps he will, my dear," said Stephen. "He is in a sad way entirely, poor fellow."
He opened the window.
"I believe I will go out this way, if I may. I do not altogether trust your tigers."
"Captain Etheridge, sir," he said, "will you do me a service now?"
"With all the pleasure in life," said Etheridge, turning his round, benevolent face from the scuttle, where he held it in the hope of air.
"Something happened today that caused me uneasiness. I must beg you to call upon Mr. Canning and desire him to give me satisfaction for a blow."
"A blow?"
cried Etheridge, his face instantly changing to a look of profound concern.
"Oh, dear me. No apology in that case, I presume.
But did you say Canning? Ain't he a Jew?"
"You don't have to fight a Jew, Doctor.
You must not put your life at risk for a Jew. Let a file of marines tan his unbelieving hide and ram a piece of bacon down his throat and leave it at that.
We see things differently, said Stephen. I have a particular devotion to Our Lady, who was a Jewess, and I cannot feel my race superior to her. Besides, I feel for the man. I will fight him with the best will in the world.
You do him too much honour, said Etheridge, dissatisfied and upset. But you know your own business best, of course. You cannot be expected to stomach a blow. And yet again, having to fight a commercial fellow is like being forced into an unequal match, or having to marry a maidservant because you have got her with child. Should you not like to fight someone else? Well, I shall have to put on my regimentals. I should not do it for anyone but you, Maturin, not in this damned heat. I hope you can find a second that understands these things. A Christian, that's all.
He went to his cabin, worried and displeased, reappeared in his red coat, already damp with sweat, and putting his head through the door, he made a last appeal.
Are you sure you would not like to fight somebody else? A bystander, say, who saw the blow.
It might not have quite the same effect, said Stephen, shaking his head. And Etheridge, I may rely upon your discretion, of course.
Oh, I know what o'clock it is, said Etheridge crossly. As early as possible, I suppose. Will dawn suit?
And Stephen heard him muttering.
Obstinate, don't listen to reason. Pig-headed,
as he went down the gangway.
What is the matter with our lobster?
Asked Pullings, coming into the gunroom.
I've never seen him so hellfire, Grum. Has he caught the prickly heat?
He will be cooler and more collected in the evening.
On his return, Etheridge was much cooler, and almost satisfied.
Well, at least he has some respectable friends, he said. I spoke to Colonel Burke of the company's service, a very gentlemanlike man, quite the thing, and we agreed on pistols at 20 paces. I hope that suits.
Certainly. I am obliged to you, Etheridge.
The only thing I have left to do is to view the ground. We agreed to meet after the Chief Justice's party when it will be cooler.
Oh, never trouble your kind heart, Etheridge. I shall be content with any usual ground.
Etheridge frowned and said,
No, no, I do hate any irregularity in affairs of this kind. It is strange enough already without the seconds not viewing the ground.
You are too good. I have prepared you a bowl of iced punch. Pray drink off a glass or so.
You have been preparing your pistols too, said Etheridge, nodding at the open case. I do recommend corning the powder uncommon fine, but I'm not to tell you anything about powder and shot. This is capital punch. I could drink it forever.
Stephen walked into the great cabin.
Jack, he said, it is weeks since we played a note. What do you say to a bout this evening, if you are not too taken up with your bollards and capstan bars?
Have you come aboard, my plum? Cried Jack,
looking up from the bosun's accounts with a beaming face.
I have such news for you. We are to carry treasure, and the freight will see me clear.
What is freight?
It means I'm clear of debt.
That is news indeed. Ha ha! I give you joy with all my heart. I am delighted, amazed.
I will explain it to you with figures the moment my accounts are done. But damn paperwork for today. Had you any particular music in mind?
The Boccherini, C major, perhaps.
Why, that is the strangest thing. The adagio has been running through my head this last hour and more, yet I ain't in the least melancholy. Far from it! Ha ha!
He rosined his bow and said,
Stephen, I took your advice. I've written to Sophie, asking her to come out to Madeira. Canning sends it overland.
Stephen nodded and smiled, hummed the true note and found it on his cello. They tuned, nodded, tapped 3 times, each with his eye fixed on the other's bow, and dashed away into the brilliant, heart-lifting first movement. On and on, lost in the music, intertwined, a lovely complexity of sound, on through the near desperation of the adagio, on and on with such fire and attack to the very height and the majestic, triumphant close.
"Lord, Stephen,"
said Jack, leaning back and laying his fiddle carefully down,
"we have never played so well."
"It is a noble piece. I revere that man. Listen, Jack, here are some papers I must confide to you, the usual things. I fight Canning in the morning, alas."
A dense curtain fell instantly, cutting off all but formal communication between them. After a pause, Jack said,
"Who is your second?"
"Etheridge."
I will come with you. That was why there was all that firing on the quarter-deck, of course. You would not mind it if I were to have a word with him?
Not at all. But he has gone to the Chief Justice's. He is to view the ground with a Colonel Burke after the party. Never vex your heart for me, Jack. I am used to these things. More used to them than you, I dare say.
Oh, Stephen, said
Jack,
this is a damned black ending to the sweetest day.
"This is where we usually settle our affairs, in Calcutta," said Colonel Burke, leading them across the moonlit Maidan. "There is the road over the Alipur Bridge, do you see? Conveniently near at hand. And yet behind these trees it is as discreet and secluded as you could wish."
"Colonel Burke," said Jack, "as I understand it, the offence was not given in public. I believe any expression of regret would meet the case. I have a great esteem for your principal, and I say this out of consideration for him. Pray do all you can. My man is deadly."
Burke gave him a broad stare.
"So is mine," he said, in an offended tone. "He dropped Harlow like a bird in Hyde Park. But even if he were not, it would not signify. He don't want pluck, as I know very well. I should not be here else. Of course, if your man chooses to put with a blow and turn the other cheek, I have nothing more to say. Blessed are the peacemakers."
Jack commanded himself. There was little hope of piercing through Burke's deep stupidity, but he went on.
"Canning must certainly have been in wine. The least admission of this, a general expression, will answer. It will be satisfactory. And if need be, I shall use my authority to make it so."
"Confine your man to his quarters, you mean? Well, you have your own ways in the Navy, I see. It would scarcely answer with us. I will carry your message, of course, but I cannot answer for its coming to anything. I have never had a principal more determined to give satisfaction in a regular way. He is a rare Plucton."
In his journal, Stephen wrote, "At most times the diarist may believe he is addressing his future self, but the real height of diary writing is the gratuitous entry, as this may prove to be. Why should tomorrow's meeting affect me in this way? I have been out many, many times. It is true my hands are not what they were, and in growing older I have lost the deeply illogical but deeply anchored conviction of immortality. But the truth of the matter is that now I have so much to lose. I am to fight Canning. Made as we are, it was inevitable, I suppose, but how deeply I regret it. I cannot feel ill will towards him, and although in his present state of confused passion and shame and disappointment I have no doubt he will try to kill me, I do not believe he feels any towards me except as the catalyst of his unhappiness. For my part, I shall, sub deo, nick his arm, no more. Good Mr. White would call my sub deo gross blasphemy, and I am tempted to throw down some observations on the matter, but peccavi nimis cogitatione, verbo et opere. I must find my priest and go quickly to sleep. Sleep is the thing. Sleep with a quietened mind."
From this sleep, but a sleep troubled by hurrying, disjointed dreams, Jack woke him at 2 bells in the morning watch, and as they dressed they heard young Babington on deck, singing Lovely Peggy in a sweet undertone, as cheerful as the rising day. They came out of the cabin into the deathly reek lying over the Hooghly and the interminable mud-flats, and at the gangway they found Etheridge, Malister, and Bondon. Under the peepal trees, on the deserted Maidan, a silent group was waiting for them. Canning, 2 friends, a surgeon, and some men to keep the ground. 2 closed carriages at a distance. Burke came forward.
"Good morning, gentlemen," he said. "There is no accommodating the affair. Etheridge, if you are happy that there is light enough, I think we should place our men. Unless, of course, your principal chooses to withdraw."
Canning was wearing a black coat, and he buttoned it high over his neckcloth. There was light enough now, a fine, clear grey, to see him perfectly. Perfectly composed, grave and withdrawn, but his face was lined and old, colourless. Stephen took off his coat, and then his shirt, folding it carefully.
"What are you doing?" whispered Jack.
"I always fight in my breeches. Cloth carried into a wound makes sad work, my dear."
The seconds paced out the ground, examined the pistols and placed their men. A 3rd closed carriage drew up. With a familiar butt and the balanced weight in his hand, Stephen's expression changed to one of extreme coldness. His pale eyes, fixed with impersonal lethal intensity upon Canning, who had taken up his stance, right foot forward, his whole body in profile. All the men there stood motionless, silent, concentrated as though upon an execution of a sacrament.
"Gentlemen," said Burke, "you may fire upon the signal."
Canning's arm came up, and along the glint of his own barrel, Stephen saw the flash and instantly loosened his finger from the trigger. The enormous impact on his side and across his breast came at the same moment as the report. He staggered, shifted his unfired pistol to his left hand and changed his stance. The smoke drifted away on the heavy air and he saw Canning plain, his head high, thrown back with that Roman Emperor air. The barrel came true, wavered a trifle, and then steadied. His mouth tightened, and he fired. Canning went straight down, rose to his hands and knees, calling for his second pistol, and fell again. His friends ran to him, and Stephen turned away.
"Are you all right, Stephen?"
He nodded, still as hard and cold as ever, and said to Mallister,
"Give me that lint."
He mopped the wound, and while Mallister probed it, murmuring,
"Struck the third rib, cracked it, deviated across the sternum. The ball is awkwardly lodged. Meant to kill you, the dog. I'll clap a cingulum about it."
He watched the far group, and his heart sank. The wicked reptilian look faded, giving way to one of hopeless sadness. That dark flow of blood under the feet of the men gathered round Canning could mean only one thing. He had missed his aim. Mallister, holding the end of the bandage in his mouth, followed his glance and nodded.
"Subclavian, or aorta itself," he muttered through the cloth. "I will just pin this end and step over for a word with our colleague."
He came back and nodded gravely.
"Dead?" said Etheridge, and looked hesitantly at Stephen, wondering whether to congratulate him.
The look of utter dejection kept him silent. While Bondon drew the charge from the second pistol and ranged them both in their cases, Etheridge walked over to Burke. They exchanged a few words, saluted formally, and parted. People were already moving about the maiden. The eastern sky showed red. Jack said,
"We must get him aboard at once. Bondon, hail the carriage."